what a commitment we're making when we say that we are going to serve God. We're going to remain steadfast, unmovable, and we will always be abounding in the work that God gives us to do. We're here because God wants us to do something. We've been talking about the state of our society and trying to figure out how we interact with that society. We talked about pluralism, introduced the subject last week. It's a situation in which people of different social classes, religions, races, etc., are together in a society, but continue to have their distinct, different traditions and interests. Now, Merriam-Webster gives a second definition, the belief that people are of different social classes, religions, races, etc., should live together in society. And we introduced the idea of pluralism using a framework that was suggested by Mr. Carson in a book called The Gagging of God. It's an interesting book. If you get an opportunity, you might want to read it. Don't agree with everything that he says, but he makes a lot of good points. He introduces this by talking about three different aspects of pluralism. Now, last week, we talked about empirical or just factual pluralism. We live in a diverse society. There is no questioning that our society is diverse. Today, we're going to talk about what he describes as a cherished pluralism. And beyond simply recognizing that we live in a diverse society, a cherished pluralism actually admires the fact that we live in a pluralistic society. It cherishes the diversity that exists among us. And then in a couple of weeks when I return, we're going to talk about philosophical pluralism. And that's a little bit more difficult. When he talks about philosophical pluralism, what he's talking about is the suggestion that nobody can really understand the Bible, and so we have to accommodate the fact that there are a lot of different understandings of biblical information. And we'll talk more about that when I return. But let's turn our attention to the idea of cherished pluralism. And I want to begin in an odd place when we're talking about pluralism. I want to go back to what happened with Abraham in Genesis 12. Now, this is what Nolan read for us this morning, Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. And you remember that in that context, God says, get up, leave your land. And I'm going to do three things. It's important we understand that there are three parts of this great promise that God makes to Abraham. First, I'm going to give you a land. You're going to leave the land where you are, but I'll give you another one. Understand how much it took for Abraham to believe that because he'd never seen that land. God says, first, I'm going to give you a land. Second, he says, I'm going to make you a great nation. At this time, Abraham has no children. It's as if Abraham and his family are going to die out when Abraham finally passes away. That's not to be the case. God says, I will make you a great nation. And then, perhaps for us, most importantly, he says, in your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. That's the Messiah. That's Jesus. A promise that was made in the beginning in the garden after Adam and Eve had sinned. It's a promise that's repeated to Abraham. It's a promise that was repeated to Abraham's children. Abraham's people were to be a chosen people by God. They were supposed to be distinct, different from everybody else. But, and this is an important point, Israel is not the only people that were blessed by God. Now, anytime you have someone who's chosen and blessed, there's a temptation to think, I'm better than you are. Because I was chosen and I was blessed. But let's think about that for a minute. You know, Israel wasn't the only nation that was chosen. In Deuteronomy, the second chapter, you find Moses before the children of Israel are going to take the land that had been promised. Remember, that was land that was part of the promise that was made to Abraham. It's the land of Canaan. He gives them some instructions. There are a lot of important parts to his instruction. He says, when I bring you into the land and I give it to you, don't forget who gave it to you. You didn't create this nation on your own. I created the nation. You didn't take this land on your own. I gave you this land. But he says some other things that are really important to remember. First, he reminded them, Esau's family. You remember who Esau was? One of the descendants from Abraham. He was Jacob's brother, the older one who should have received the blessing, but God chose Jacob to bless. Esau's family is given the land of Edom. Now, if you look at that on a map, Israel at this point has been wandering the wilderness for 40 years after they left Egyptian captivity. They're about ready to cross the Jordan River and to go in and take the land that God has decided that he's going to give them. But there are some other nations that are already in this area. There were Canaanite people that were in the land of Canaan. If you look in the red, over by the coast, you see the Philistine people. You look down towards the south, you look at the kingdom of Edom. In the purple, you'll see the kingdom of Moab. In that orange funky color that Texas chose to be their colors. If you look at that orange funky color, that's Ammon. And if you look up to the top, you see that's the kingdom of Aaron of Damascus. So when they're coming into the land, Moses reminds them, don't take the land that God gave to Esau. You know, we've been reading in the Old Testament, and this happens every time I read chronologically through the Bible. I start seeing things that I'd seen before, but I'd forgotten. Deuteronomy 2, beginning at verse 1. This is Moses. He's recounting everything that has happened. He says, we turned and journeyed into the wilderness in the direction of the Red Sea, as the Lord told me. And for many days we traveled around Mount Seir. Then the Lord said to me, you've been traveling around this mountain country long enough. Turn northward, command the people You are to pass through the territory of your brothers, the people of Esau, who live in Seir. That's the Edomites. Okay? They will be afraid of you, so be very careful. Do not contend with them, for I will not give you any of their land. No, not so much as for the sole of your foot to tread on, because I've given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. So I'm feeling pretty good about myself. God has made a land promise to me. He's promised to bless me, make me a great nation. And then I have to confront the idea that, hey, God also chose Esau. And he gave him a land too. I'm a little deflated right now. You drop down to verse 16. He gives them some further instruction. So as soon as all the men of war had perished and we were dead from among the people. Remember, that's what happened when they first were told to go into the land. They sent spies in. They looked at the land. They came back, said, we can't take it. And God said, because you don't have any faith in me, all your fighting men are going to die. None of them over 20 years old are going to go into the land. So they turned, went back out to the east, and they wandered around in the hill country. That's what Moses had said. They weren't able to go into the land. The Lord said to me, today you are to cross the border of Moab at Ar. And when you approach the territory of the people of Ammon, do not harass them or contend with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession, because I've given it to the sons of Lot for a possession. Now, I'm deflated a little bit more. God blessed me, but he also blessed Edom, gave them a land. He also blessed Lot, gave him a land, and I'm not to take it. It's his. Ishmael's family had settled in Ammon. And if you go back in time, when Ishmael had to leave Abraham, Ishmael was told, I'll make you a great nation. If you're not careful, it seems like God cares about everybody. So me being a chosen people is not quite as exclusive a club as we sometimes think. Now, they were to come into the land that was inhabited by the Canaanites. They were to destroy those people. But think about what this means. Israel is unique. I said that I was a little deflated if I'm an Israelite, because I'm beginning to understand that God cares about a lot of people, not just me, but I'm still unique. In what way was Israel unique? Well, think about Ishmael. Ishmael is told that he would be the father of a great nation, but Ishmael's never given a land. Then you look at Lot. He's told he's going to be a great nation. His descendants are going to be a great nation. He's given land as well. What about Esau? Esau is a great nation. He's given land as well. Israel, great nation. Just like Esau and Lot and Ishmael, they're given a land, just like Esau and Lot, but it's only Israel that has the promise that in their seed the Messiah would be found. Israel gets an extra part of the blessing. And Israel was also given the law that would keep them pure and would lead them to the Messiah. So, yes, Israel is special. Israel is unique. They're not unique in the sense that they're the only people that God blessed. They're not unique in the sense that they're the only people to whom God gave a land. They are unique in the sense that they're the only people through whom God said the Messiah would come. That's Jesus. Now, the promises were always contingent upon certain conditions. Remember the promised land, the promise of being a great nation, and disobedience caused Israel, the northern 10 tribes, to go into Assyrian captivity. It caused Judah to be going away into Babylonian captivity. The promises were not abrogated. The fact that they were disobedient didn't mean that God wouldn't keep his promise. Remember, he had already said, I will let the Messiah come through you. And what it took was a faithful remnant among all of those people that wanted to serve God, no matter how disobedient the culture in general had become. This remnant would give all nations the blessing of the Messiah. Thank goodness that it happened that way. Now, Edom and Moab had lost land that had been promised to them in the wars with Saul and David in about 1000 BC. And you can read about those wars. And as you read through the Old Testament, eventually you'll come to the time that Saul and David conquered Edom and Moab. Their disobedience isn't chronicled the way that Israel and Judah's disobedience is chronicled for us. We know exactly what happened with Israel and Judah. That was the story. In other words, it was the history that had to be there so we would understand the Messiah was coming. God didn't give us the history of Edom and Moab to the same extent that he gave us the history of Israel. So I don't know what happened. But if Edom and Moab were anything like Israel, and they were, their disobedience, even though it's not recorded, caused them to lose their promised land. The Bible record simply focuses on the messianic lineage. And Jesus changes everything about this for the better. Ephesians, the second chapter, at verse 14, is where the Apostle Paul makes us aware that it's Jesus that breaks down the wall of partition that existed between people. Now, what was that wall? Was it a wall that existed only between Israel and everybody else? Or was that wall that existed a wall that existed between a lot of different groups? Moab didn't like Edom. Nobody liked Ammon. Nobody liked Israel. You had a bunch of different groups that had been blessed that were told to leave each other alone. And then God broke down those walls. This is Ephesians 2, beginning at verse 14. He says, He himself is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in his flesh the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances, that he might create in himself one new man in place of the two, and he might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross and thereby kill the hostility. Yes, the emphasis here is the breaking down of the wall that existed because of the giving of the law. But Jesus didn't just break down a wall between Jews and Gentiles. He broke down all the walls that had existed. Jesus has not come to create a situation that is parallel to what existed in the Old Testament, where you had Israel, Edom, Moab, Ammon. They're all blessed by God, and they're told to coexist with each other. That's not what Jesus came to establish. What Jesus came to establish was oneness. Just one. All people. Together. And that's important. When you have Old Testament paradigm, lots of different people that are blessed by God, what you get is tribalism. I care about the people in my tribe. We're blessed. We're important. You have to understand that we're blessed. We're important. And by the way, I also have to understand that you are blessed, but we don't interact. We don't have anything to do with each other. That's tribalism. Jesus didn't come to establish a society where, after the death of George Floyd, Black Lives Matter. Jesus came to establish a society where all lives matter. None more than anybody else. And if you think you're more special than anybody else, then you need to read what Jesus did. Because that's not what he established. Jesus came to give us one body. Ephesians 3, and beginning at Ephesians 4, beginning at verse 3, he says, we need to be eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit, the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called, in one hope that belongs to your call. We are one body together. And I fear that the notion of a cherished pluralism contradicts the spirit of one body. Now, the notion that all people are important, absolutely. But the notion that I'm important over here and you're important over here And we're equally important is not one body. So I don't know about cherished pluralism. I think a lot about that, about the notion that everybody has to have their group. If you were to go to the University of Oregon today, you would find a Black student union, and you'd find an Asian student union, and you'd find a BIPOC student union. You'd find all different kinds of student unions. That's not unity. That's a poor substitute for unity. And we're not going to have, we're not going to buy into that. We're going to be a united people in the sight of God. And we're not going to let anybody say that you matter less than anybody else, because we're all one. Well, this is not something that I have seen discussed a great deal. Anytime I come up with an idea that I don't see discussed, and you know, I think as I read the religious literature that there are a lot of people that would probably disagree with me. There's something to think about. If you want to put on Jesus this morning and be one with everybody, if you want to put on Jesus this morning, just like Kirsten did, we would love to have you do that. We'll help you. We have a pool. We can baptize you here. We can do it anywhere. Doesn't matter. But if you want that kind of oneness, the only place you're going to find it is Jesus. So put him on. Accept his sacrifice. Make it yours, and we'll help you.